Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. His life sounds like something out of a movie, but today we're going to hear the real-life adventures of a former FBI agent who, during his 20-year career with the FBI, recovered more than $225 million worth of stolen art and cultural property. We'll also hear why art crime is so profitable and why recovery of stolen art and historical artifacts is so important to our history and cultural heritage. Robert Whitman is the former senior investigator and founder of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's National Art Crime Team. He has represented the United States around the world conducting investigations and teaching international police and museums in investigation, recovery, and security techniques. He now owns his own security and recovery consulting firm. It's called Robert Whitman, Inc., and we welcome Bob to the show. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. That's $225 million worth of stolen art and cultural property over the course of a 20-year career. In comparison to that, it's at least a $6 billion industry, art theft
is. Well, yeah, worldwide. And it's not really art theft. What we do is we call it illicit cultural property. And it's a type of crime. And it also includes frauds, forgeries, and fakes. So when you put theft together with frauds, forgeries, and fakes in the art market internationally, it's estimated to be a $6 billion industry.
Now, I mentioned, I said, why is it so profitable? That was a question early on. I didn't think, it doesn't sound like it is that profitable.
Well, as I say, the theft part of it is not profitable when we talk about these large paintings that are stolen, the Picassos, the Renoirs, the Monets are worth multi-millions of dollars. Those are recovered. And generally speaking, the thieves who take those pieces have a really hard time selling them. I always say that they're better thieves than they are businessmen, because what they do is they go out, they plan the crime, but then they don't know how to sell the piece. So, the real art in an art heist is not the stealing, it's the selling.
Right, and that's a lot where you got involved. It wasn't necessarily about prevention, although you are sort of obsessed, you've said, when you go into a gallery or a museum with looking at the security measures that they've taken.
Well, I maybe obsessed is a little bit of a strong word. I am interested, though. I like to look at the security systems to make sure that they're good. And I have to say, in the U.S., it's not a real big problem. We don't have a whole lot of problems with art heists, big art heists in museums here. Of course, that being said, the biggest art heist in the world occurred in Boston in 1990, when the Isabella Starr Gardner Museum theft occurred, and that remains today the biggest single property crime in U.S. history that was known. So we have good security, but it does happen.
Tell us about that Boston case.
Well, back in 1990 on St. Patty's Day night, two individuals went to the museum dressed as Boston police officers. They made their way into the museum. The guards were told never to let anybody in. There was two guards there. They were both part-time college students, and they didn't know any better, so they let the policemen in. Of course, as soon as they got in, they found that they weren't really policemen. They were just dressed that way. They tied the guards up, and they went around the museum for the next hour and so minutes and stole 13 items of art, 11 paintings. The value of the paintings at that time were about $300 million. And it's, the largest single property crime in U.S. history. I mean, who would have thought that art would be that crime? I mean, people think of armored car robberies, they think of bank robberies, but no, it was an art theft from a museum. And today those paintings are worth about $500 million, and there is a $5 million reward for the recovery.
My guest is Robert Whitman. He's former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He's also written a book with John Schiffman. It's called Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. If you have a question or comment for Bob, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So a $6 billion a year, at least, business of art theft, art crime, art-related crime, but not a lot of resources are thrown at it, particularly in the United States.
Well, that's true. It's an amazing statistic when you look at the fact that the United States really is responsible for about 40% of the entire art industry in the world. we buy about $80 billion worth of art and artifacts in the United States every year. So as a result, you know, we think we'd have the highest law enforcement capability as far as that industry was concerned. But the truth is there's a lot more that's being done overseas. In Italy, just for instance, there's 300 members of the Carabinieri brigades that do art theft protection. In Spain, there's two squads in Madrid that do specifically art theft investigations, and more than 30 policemen in Paris, in the OCBC, that are that have that job. So, you know, when we look at that, up until 2005, when we started the National Art Crime Team for the FBI, we didn't have anybody that actually was specifically geared towards these types of investigations, and now they do. So it's a good thing. It's starting to become more and more prevalent.
You know, you mentioned in the book and at the top of the hour, we used a quote from an interview you did about who the bad guys are. They're not movie star quality necessarily.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Does it make your tell us about them. I mean, it's a range of people, from a guy that kind of almost walks in off the street to underworld crime figures, all sorts of stuff.
Well, you know, it's valuable property, and depending on where it's stolen from and where it's done, there's different types of people who are involved in it. It goes everywhere from just a shoplifter, you know, who has an opportunistic period or ability to go in and steal a piece, to experts, you know, who have access to collections, to real, you know, hardened criminals and thieves who decide that this is a payday for them. And it depends actually too on where you go. In the U.S., we have a lot of access criminals. Those are people who have, you know, ability to go in to look at museums, collections. They're people who work there. I hate to say this, but there's a statistic out there that about 88% of all crimes from museums are done by, quote, insiders.
Mm-hmm.
And that's too bad. I mean, but when we say insiders, Dan, we don't necessarily mean people who just work there. We also are talking about people who have access to the collections. So you have experts that go in and do studies, and as they do them, they steal pieces. And there's many, many stories of that, you know, that have occurred. But when you go to Europe, there's a lot of armed robbery, and that's a whole different type of situation. And the reason for that is because of the proximity of the borders between the countries, the openness of the borders, you know, now, and also the fact that many of the police departments and the guards in those museums are not armed. So, you know, the criminals go in with guns and they have the drop on the guards and they can kind of do what they need to do.
Let's talk about you for a little while, because you didn't get to this. This isn't something you study in college and say, I want to grow up and be an art crimes investigator.
Right.
For the FBI, of all things.
Well, what happened with me, I started in the FBI in 1988. I was in Baltimore, and I went in the bureau, and they convinced me. They said, this is a great job, you know, and I was thinking about doing it because I always was interested in it. And I'll never forget, there was a guy named Gary who was the applicant coordinator in Baltimore. And Gary says to me one day, he said, Mr. Whitman, he says, you know, at some point you can be driving around in a high-powered car. You know, you'd be the only law enforcement around for 100 miles. You could be on the reservations out west and have a shotgun, and you'll be the only guy for 100 miles. And I looked at him. I thought, that's kind of an interesting thought, you know. And the next thing I knew, I was in Philadelphia, and I was the only policeman for 50 feet.
And you, in your line of work, you didn't carry a gun very often at all.
Well, no, I carry a gun every day. I mean, okay. I worked in Philadelphia. I worked all around the world in 20 different countries. But, you know, in my normal everyday jobs, yeah, I carried a gun all the time. But what I said in the book, I didn't wear guns undercover.
Okay.
And the reason for that was because, I think your best weapon undercover is your mind and your ability to speak. Because, you know, if it comes to where we're whipping out guns, you know, we all got a big problem at that point. So I always figured that, you know, I didn't want to heighten the danger by wearing guns and you know, taking guns into those operations. I did on one case involving the heist of a pair of Picassos from the granddaughter of Pablo Picasso in Paris. They were worth about $60 million. We did an undercover operation out of Miami where we recovered those paintings. And then the individuals in Miami decided that I was the person who had turned them in, so they wanted to do harm to me. So in the next meeting with them, of course, I did have a gun in each pocket. But that worked out fine. We talked them out of it.
My guest is Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He is also the author, with John Schiffman, of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. Question or comments? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Art values haven't always been what they are now. This, you wrote about that, how it's kind of started to turn around in the 50s.
Right, right. It, you know, up until the late 50s and through the decade of the 60s, you know, paintings were not going for $1 million. It wasn't until that time that a Picasso actually sold for $1 million. So these values were not, you know, not where they are today. I mean, I think last year Picasso broke a record at auction of over $130 million or $140 million, unbelievable amounts. And that's led to the rise in art crime and the popularity within criminal organizations of stealing art. Again, they're not good businessmen, so they think to themselves, well, you know, they can see the Picasso, they see it's worth this much money, quote, at auction, but they don't realize that the reason you can sell that piece is because you have good title, you have good history, what we call provenance, and you have the ability to move it, you know, in the legitimate markets. When you try to sell that in a undercover market or, you know, a black market, what happens is you get caught. That's how we recover these very valuable paintings. It's when they come back to market, whether it's through an undercover police operation or at an auction or sale.
One of your earlier cases involved the crystal ball, and,
right,
and another piece that just sort of wound up. Apparently, can you tell us about that? Because that was the guy who came in and just...
Oh, absolutely. Well,
right off the street, it seemed like.
Yeah, you know, that was an armed robbery of a museum. That was the very first case
okay,
that I ever had as an FBI agent. And what happened was I was transferred, I was telling the story before, from Baltimore to Philadelphia, and I was put on a property crime squad that was specialized in doing truck hijacking, believe it or not. And so I get to the squad, and on the very day I'm there, they tell me that, you know, you've got some cases they're going to assign me, and I got the museum heist. There were two of them, actually, one from the University of Pennsylvania Museum and one from the Rodin Museum. The crystal ball came from the Pennsylvania Museum. Anyway, the reason I got those cases was because I was the next guy up on the wheel. Nobody else wanted them. I was a new guy, you know. So I got the cases, and we were able to actually solve them over an amount of time, about a two-year period. And as a result, they sent me to the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia for art, fine art school. And that's where I started with the art as well. And then from there on out, that's what I did for 20 years, was art theft investigations. What they didn't realize is that I was actually in the art business, because my parents were antiques dealers. So I did know how to make an actual business deal in the art world. And that's really what it comes down to. When we talk about art theft, it's really about the art business.
And so where those pieces wound up,
yeah,
the guy,
yeah,
probably found he couldn't sell them, you think, or he just stashed them? Or?
Well, what happened there? From the crystal ball situation, what had happened was there was a burglary at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Somebody had gone in when they were doing renovations on the museum and stolen the crystal ball. And this crystal ball was about 54 pounds. It's the second largest crystal ball in the world. And it was owned by the Dowager Empress of China. And that's where it was collected from in the 1930s at the university. Well, this piece is like the centerpiece of the Asian gallery in the museum. It's a beautiful, beautiful exhibition there. And they took the ball, they took the stand that it was on, called the Wave. It's made of silver. And they stole a 3,000-year-old statue of the god Osiris, Egyptian god. So they took all three pieces, and the next morning we found the Wave right there on a bridge stanchion, because they couldn't carry it all. It was all too heavy. But for about 2 years, we couldn't find anything else. Finally, we got a call that one of the workers at the museum had seen the crystal, had seen the god Osiris, I'm sorry, in a secondhand shop. So when we went and we recovered that, and then we interviewed the individuals, we found out that the piece came from the same house as the crystal ball was in. So we went back and talked to the owner of that house, and he, as it turns out, he tells us that, hey, yeah, we had the ball here, but I gave it away. I didn't know what it was. And he hadn't stolen it. He found it in his backyard. I guess I think some kids took it, you know, as a prank, you know, for their front, mm-hmm, house or something. And they dropped it off in the backyard of this place, at this house. It was right along the route. And I said, well, what'd you do with it? And he said, well, I gave it to my housekeeper. And I said, your housekeeper? Why would you give that to your housekeeper? He said, well, because she's a witch. So, you know, you can't make it up. So this was the witch's crystal ball, right? And luckily, she was a good witch, you know, as it turned out.
And when you found it, it had a baseball cap on it.
Yeah, we went to the house in Trenton, my partner and I at the FBI, and we went to the house, knocked on the door. It was a young woman, about 27 years old, blonde, very pretty. And she said, the piece is upstairs. So we went up and looked at it, and it was sitting on her dresser, and it had her boyfriend's baseball cap. And this piece was worth $350,000 at the time. Yeah, that was the value of it. And she couldn't believe that she had this thing and it was that valuable, you know, and it was a good recovery.
My guest is Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He is also the author of a book. It's called Priceless, co-author of a book, Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. He will be keynote speaker and signing books this Saturday at the Columbus Art Design and Antique Market at the Columbus Museum of Art, sponsored by Garth's Auctions. You can find out more about that. We'll have a link for you on our website at WOSU.org. Stay tuned. We're going to continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Weekday mornings, prepare for the day with NPR's Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne and hear local news updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team. Listen to Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 65 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today and the clouds will be increasing with a chance of rain this afternoon, a high of 74. Rain showers are likely tonight, a low of 52 degrees. A slight chance of rain for Thursday, also some sunshine and a high of 71. And then partly cloudy for Thursday night and chilly, a low of 43.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus College of Art and Design, offering continuing education courses to update your creative career skills. Information and online registration are available now at www.ccad.edu.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Robert Whitman. He's former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. We're also talking about his book, Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. He'll be in town speaking on Saturday at the Columbus Art Design and Antique Market at the Columbus Museum of Art, sponsored by Garth's Auctions. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org. We have a message from Charlotte on Facebook. She writes, how can a layperson determine whether she is dealing with a reputable appraiser, restorer, or vendor? Is there some professional association for referrals? What are the warning signals to an honest person that it's time to demur from a purchase and contact you?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know who Charlotte is, but she's really on the ball with that. You know, there are appraisal associations that you can go through, the American Association of Appraisers. There's a number of them, and they're in the phone book, and you might want to check their credentials when you're going to get somebody to actually do that. They should be a member of one of the certified organizations. That's the first thing. As far as people doing conservation, there's also groups like that. I mean, you can look that up right up on the internet as well. Professionals of America is another one. So there's a number of different ones you can do for that. So they should have their credentials done. And then as far as, you know, when you're going to buy a piece of art, you know, if you're going to buy it from a gallery, you know, make sure that you have a guarantee of authenticity. What it's supposed to be, and secondly, that you have good title. I mean, a lot of times people and forget that the good title is just as important as authenticity. Because if there's a gap in the title, let's say, especially from between 1925, say, and 1945, you know, there's a lot of problems right now with paintings being recovered and taken back from collections because they were supposedly taken by the Nazis or whatever during the Second World War, and that's just one example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just that. I mean, also the fact that, you know, if you don't have good title or good history, you know, at any point, someone can challenge the fact that you own a painting. So you need to have good title to make sure that, you know, you don't have that problem because you could lose your money.
I thought it was interesting when you described how some thieves to get a proper, you know, a piece back on the market legitimately, they get provenance by offering it to museums and then having museums reject it.
Oh, sure.
And then they've got the paperwork saying, well, they rejected it because they don't have space or they don't have, it won't fit into their schedule or something.
Right. right. Well, sometimes, you know, that's what they'll do. They'll offer these pieces, and they're fakes. And then what happens is the museum basically is not interested in it. But the museum's not going to write back and say that your piece is a fake. They'll just make some excuse. And at that point, then they do have paperwork from a legitimate institution saying, talking about that specific object. And so now they have some sort of provenance that they can show to use that it's been legitimized. And that's just one of the scams, you know, that these individuals do. There's a lot of scams out there when it comes to art and values, you know.
You're pretty much a one-man operation. There wasn't even an FBI art crime team before you came around. Why the disinterest by law enforcement? Why isn't there more interest in it that way?
Well, it's not that it's not of interest. What happens is, Ann, is that it's considered to be a property crime. And just in general, property crime is pretty low on the list. And I understand that. I mean, you know, when you have murders going on robberies and rapes and that type of thing, those personal crimes, you know, take a higher priority than the property crimes such as art theft and motor vehicle theft. But the way I looked at it was the art theft was much more high priority than, say, a motor vehicle theft, because you're talking about cultural history. And you're talking about the history of the world. And when these pieces are taken, they're much more valuable. I think there's much more of a value with a Monet than a Chevrolet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that, not just financially, but also for the cultural property aspect of it and the worth of it to us all, you know, as members of the world community.
And you're not just talking about art per se, but cultural items. And
exactly.
There was the case of the solid gold...
Peruvian backflap.
Backflap.
Can
you tell us about that case? Because that was pretty
sure.
Early on as well.
Well, what happens is that, you know, when people talk about art theft, they start thinking about strictly paintings and things of that nature. But that's not the case. We're actually talking about illicit cultural property, as I said before. And cultural property is the property from nations all around the world, you know, that comes from their development. So it involves pre-Columbian art. It involves, you know, Asian art, African masks and whatnot. These are all pieces of cultural property, pieces from Iraq, you know, from the cradles of civilization. And that's what we're talking about protecting as well. That particular case involved a 2.5-pound piece of gold that was actually looted from a tomb of the Moche King. It was known as the Lord of Sipan in Peru. And that was done in 1987. That was looted. We recovered it in 1998. After it had been offered for sale for $1.6 million. In that case, I was working undercover as a buyer of gold and pre-Columbian artifacts, and we were able to do that case actually in Newark, New Jersey, where we made the arrest.
You know, the problem with the looting, you made an interesting point. It's obvious, but it was interesting to read about, that it's not just about recovering the object. What looters have done is a permanent damage to the process of looking back into our history.
Oh, exactly. I mean, when sites are not dug archaeologically, we lose all the intelligence, all the information we could have gotten from that specific archaeological site. So they go in, you know, basically they just dig through, they discard what they don't want. You know, there's no detailed map of how the site was laid out. So we get nothing from it. And what you end up having is just really nice-looking baubles. I mean, you know, nice pieces of artwork, maybe, or something of that nature, but you don't have the information, the scientific information about the civilization. And what was so important about that particular artifact that we recovered, that civilization did not leave a written language. Okay, they had pictographs that they did, but that was all that we ever had. And so we didn't know about this civilization that flourished for almost 700 years. Until they did those archaeological digs. But the destruction of that site really limited the amount of information that the Peruvians could get from those sites to learn about their history.
Developing countries, poorer countries, are the worst hit by these kinds of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some estimates right now that in Peru, 90% of everything that was in the ground is gone. So that kind of gives you an idea of, you know, the immensity of the looting that can occur.
My guest is Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He's co-author of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. If you have a question or comment for Bob, give us a call, 614-292-8255. 8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Your career in the FBI took an unexpected and tragic turn in 1989 when you were involved in a car crash. You were badly injured. Your partner and best friend died. And then you faced prosecution in that case. Give us a thumbnail on what happened.
Well, it was a terrible evening. The car flipped over, and of course that occurred. And it was a terrible situation. The biggest loss there was the loss of my best friend. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we went through the situation with the prosecution because they thought that they had gotten numbers mixed up as far as alcohol, that type of thing is concerned. And in the end, it was it was all thrown out. I was vindicated, but that's not the point. The point was the loss of my friend, and it was a very trying time. I put it in the book, and the reason for that was because I didn't want anybody to think that I wasn't putting anything in that was bad or good.
Well, it also affected you as a law enforcement officer, though.
Oh, absolutely. The accident part of it did not affect me as a law enforcement officer. It was the prosecution afterwards where I saw that people do get prosecuted who are innocent, and at that point it made me realize that you have to look at both sides of every story to make sure that you have the right the situation going, and that it's not always about getting a prosecution or getting a conviction. It's about doing the right thing. And that's the most important thing when it comes to any kind of law enforcement or anything else we do. It's, you have to do the right thing.
You wrote that your newfound ability to think and feel like the accused was invaluable and that you knew it would make you a better agent, especially an undercover agent. Why?
Well, because I understood the mindset of the person that's accused, and when that occurs, there is a certain mindset that goes into effect, I would say. And as a result, I knew how to talk to these people. And how to get them to understand, the severity of the situation or whatever it was, and to try to, work out the best result for themselves.
At the beginning of the book, you tell a really great story about a sting operation you're running down in Miami, mm-hmm. and that most of the FBI agents you're working with, you're not real confident in their ability to pull off this undercover operation, that they just don't get what an art thief is like.
What happened was in that case, that was in 2006. In fact, from 2006 to 2008, I was undercover working on the Gardner case, and I was chasing one of the paintings, which was a Rembrandt seascape, and also a Vermeer, which is the only Vermeer that's missing in the world. It's called the Concert. And we had been working on that case, as I say, for 2 years. It took me from Miami to Madrid to Barcelona to Marseille to Paris, and that's where we were looking for it. Well, in this particular case, the problem was that I was working with certain individuals who had never been out of the country. I had never done an operation outside the United States. And at that point, I had been working in 20 different countries and had a lot of experience with that. And as a result, sometimes, people don't have as much experience. They don't have the background, and it puts them in a bad position. In any event, that's what happened with that case. That's what we were talking about. It is a matter of experience and being able to work these things and knowing how to do it that makes it successful. And sometimes that can be a problem.
You had a mentor at the outset in Philadelphia who kind of got you into this.
Right. Bob Bazin was the agent here in Philadelphia who was working on these cases before I got here. He's a great guy, and he and I worked together from 1988 to 1997, and we actually did these cases together oftentimes. And he was the beginning guy, the first person here in Philly who would work these cases, and then I took over from him at that point. So he was a good mentor.
You took some classes, you mentioned, at that gallery.
The Barnes Foundation.
Mm-hmm. That lasted for a year. I think it was 4 hours a week for a year. You met with the same group of people. And that was an interesting operation, how they taught art appreciation.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Barnes Foundation is one of the leading art, vistas or foundations in the United States. It's probably one of the most valuable. I believe that at this point in the game, the collection there is probably worth over $30 billion, I think. So, it's a wonderful collection. And any one of you listeners who ever gets a chance to go to the Barnes in Philly, you should absolutely do it, because you won't be able to see the immensity of the number of Cezannes and Renoirs they have on hand. It's just a wonderful place. The actual learning experience, the educational part of the courses are interesting. They're part of the Barnes philosophy. Barnes was a doctor in the early 1900s who created this collection and then left it as a teaching collection for individuals who are interested in art. And they teach his philosophy, which is okay, but I think that the real value of it is to be able to sit and for 4 hours look closely, you know, at two or three Renoirs or look at a Cezanne right next to a Renoir and look, and not just look at one, but look at five or six, next to five or six, which is something you don't normally get a chance to do in the U.S.
And he mixes them all. They've mixed them all up. They're not.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a value in contrasting and comparing.
Exactly. What he did was he created what he called wall ensembles. And so he kind of went with structure in that he would take paintings like a Renoir and put it next to a Cezanne, not so much because of comparing the piece, but because of the size and because of the subject. So interestingly enough, he doesn't do what normal museums do, which is like put a bunch of paintings together who are, you know, by the same artist on the same subject. He puts them together by different artists, which is an interesting concept if you think about it. Because then you get to contrast the different artists and see what's different, you know, what makes them different from each other. And it was interesting because in 2005, I took the art crime team there for their first annual training, you know, the agents that were on the team. And within 2 hours, you know, in working at the Barnes, I'm telling you, these agents who had no basics or no basis in art could tell the difference between a Renoir and a Cezanne. And that's a big deal when you come to, when you talk to policemen, you know, and they can tell the difference between a Renoir and a Cezanne. That's a good thing, you know.
Well, you know, you took this class and it prepared you a lot, but you also had to have some intrinsic desire to go after this kind of crime and an intrinsic appreciation for the art. What in your life sort of led up to this that suited you for it, do you think?
Well, as I said earlier, my parents were in the antiques business. So as a result, you know, I had grown up in the business, and I grew up with an appreciation of art and antiques because my dad had an extensive collection of Asian antiques. He was in during the Korean War, he was in Japan for the U.S. Air Force, and that's where he met my mother. And what he did was he fell in love with the Japanese culture and started collecting Japanese antiques. So, you know, I grew up with a household full of antiques, of these, you know, Asian antiques. And, you know, and believe me, I wasn't throwing footballs around the house. You know, I was being real careful about that. So in the end, you know, I did have the background there for it and an enjoyment and appreciation of these artworks. But, you know, going into I didn't expect to go into the FBI to do this type of work, but that's how it worked out. And it worked out real well. I was happy with it.
My guest is Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He's also author of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. He'll be the keynote speaker, and he'll be signing books as well on Saturday at the Columbus Art Design and Antique Market at the Columbus Museum of Art, sponsored by Garth's Auctions. If you have a question or comment for Bob, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Will Arnett. He co-starred in Arrested Development as Job, and on 30 Rock, he played Jack's rival, Devin Banks. Now Arnett is starring in the new comedy series Up All Night, about a sleep-deprived couple adjusting to their new lives as parents. And we'll hear from two neuroscientists who've written a new book about how a child's brain develops. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Complimenting our Chefs in the City Ohio beer tasting is a tasty auction. Support WOSU by bidding on edible and drinkable packages from the Granville Inn, Rock Mill Brewery, the Winemaker Shop, and more.
Time is running out on these packages. You can bid now, even if you don't have a ticket to the event. But hurry, the online bidding closes at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Visit WOSU.org/chefs and click on the Chefs in the City auction banner right now.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus College of Art and Design, offering continuing education courses to update your creative career skills. Information and online registration are available now at www.ccad.edu.
Cloudy skies today with a chance of showers after 3 o'clock this afternoon and a high of 74. Rain likely tonight, a low of 52. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking with Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He has traveled the world representing the United States, conducting investigations, instructing international police and museums in investigation, recovery, and security techniques. He is also co-author of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. Bob, as I'm reading the book, I feel like it's not just a movie. It almost seems like a television series to me.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to wait for a producer to give me a call.
Yeah, no calls yet. Tell us, I was going to ask you about what happens and Charlotte brought it up in her email or her Facebook message earlier. You know, if you've got something and you take it to an appraiser and how do you know you can trust them? And of course, what many of us, particularly public media followers, watch is Antiques Roadshow.
Sure.
And there's a chapter in your book about Antiques Roadshow.
Well, I have to tell you, over the course of my career, I think I've arrested somewhere around half a dozen of the appraisers on the show for doing different things, different kinds of crimes. Usually these weren't thefts. Usually these were frauds, and that type of thing. And a lot of time it has to do with, underappraising or overappraising an item in order to get a hold of it. So, you have to be careful who you go with and what you do. And it's a great show, by the way. I mean, I really enjoy watching it. And it's created a whole new generation of interested viewers who are interested in art and antiques. So that's a good thing. But, I mean, once again, it's a treasure hunt show. And hey, have you noticed that on television today, there's so many of those shows on now? with the pickers, the different kinds of pickers.
Right.
The sister pickers, the brother pickers, and everything else. And that seems to be the hot topic, the pawn stars and the pawn shops and whatever. So, and Antiques Roadshow was probably the very first of all of those and kind of spawned a whole new generation of interested viewers. And Saturday, we can actually talk about that in the talk I'll be doing, which I'm really looking forward to. We're going to be talking about that as well as an undercover operation we did in Stockholm, Sweden, and in Copenhagen, where we recovered a $35 million Rembrandt that was stolen at gunpoint, as well as a number of other cases that that we're going to talk about and show videos of and that type of thing. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the crowds on Saturday and getting together with people from Columbus.
That case involved insiders again.
Uh-huh. Right. The Antiques Roadshow involved two of the appraisers at that point who were on the show. And what they had done basically was they created a false situation where they had brought actual antiques onto the show. Now, I'm going to tell you this, and I hope your listeners aren't disappointed, but they had brought these people onto the show, and they had brought items that they themselves owned. Now, in other words, what they were doing fake appraisals on the show. And so that was done in order to create interest around the country in their appraising, which was the military material, okay? So, as a result of them bringing their own stuff on that they own, they basically paid people to come in and, bring these pieces like they were parts of their collection. And then they did these fake, setups on television. And they showed, they showed the object, they showed the person being surprised about the amount of money it was worth.
Yeah.
And it was all just a setup. In fact, the guy was actually in the appraiser's wedding as one of his groomsmen. That's how long he had known the man, So they used that as a setup for people to call in and to try to get their appraisals done on their pieces. At that point, they were underappraising, telling them, stories about where the pieces would go, and basically stealing. It was a type of theft from families around the country of their military artifacts that were owned by their, you know, their ancestors. It's from the Civil War, from the Revolutionary War, that type of thing.
Bill from Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks. I have a question about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum theft.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any theories on that? Now that Whitey Bulger's been caught, his name keeps coming up. But I think he's being blamed for everything but traffic accidents in the Boston area.
I think so, too. I think in Boston, everything's a Whitey case, isn't it? You know, I don't know if Whitey has anything to do with it or had anything to do with it. I think at the time that it occurred, Mr. Bulger might have been in a position that had he read about it the next day, he could have asked someone to find out, you know, what was going on. But as far as having a hand in it, I seriously doubt that. And the other, and to take that forward 20 years later with him living in Santa Monica, I don't think he had any interest or ability to keep up with it to find out where the paintings are today. My personal opinion is that they've been dispersed and they're not all together. And that some are in some places and some in others. And if you look at my book, I talk about that for about six chapters about the undercover operation we did from 2006 to 2008 to try to recover those two. And in the book, I tell you where they're at. So I think it's an interesting case, and it's something that really needs to be solved at some point. The really great part is that we couldn't get them back, Bill, at that point, but the great part is that we actually kind of get an idea now that they do exist, they haven't been destroyed, and they're out there.
That's good news.
Yeah, that's the best news, really, you know, because you really want to recover these items because they are really, you know, important for our culture and for basically the world culture.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
614-292-8513 if you want to speak with our guest, Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He's going to be signing his book, Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, this weekend, the Columbus Art Design and Antique Market at the Columbus Museum of Art. More information on that, WOSU.org/allsides will get you links to that information. There, some of the historical objects have some of the most amazing stories. There's the blood cloth, the battle flag of the 12th Regiment Infantry.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of times, Ann, people ask me in these interviews, what was the most important or most valuable piece that you ever recovered? And you know, there's always an answer. The answer, of course, is the next piece. There's a difference between valuable and important. It's the most interesting. It's always the next piece because, you know, you're always working on another case. But but looking back, you know, what was really interesting is I can't delineate objects by value. I mean, we recovered an original copy of the Bill of Rights that was stolen from the state of North Carolina during the Civil War. And that was actually sent there and ratified during the time of George Washington. It's one of the 13 original copies of the Bill of Rights. And that was valued at $100 million. And that is so valuable, you know. But the blood cloth that you talked about was a piece that was carried in the Civil War by an African-American regiment, one of the very first ones that was ever organized. And five individuals carrying that piece were shot out from under it. So, you know, this was the first time that these individuals in history, this African-American group, was fighting for the freedom of themselves, their children, and their grandchildren for all time to come. So what is the value of that? It was valued at about $30,000, you know, in the operation. That when we recovered it, but you know what? The cultural value is immense. So you can't really put a dollar value. That's why we called the book Priceless, because all of these pieces, all these things are priceless to their cultures. And, you know, you can't really put a dollar value on these pieces.
614-292-8513 if you want to talk with Bob Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. Give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we did have an email from James. He says, I think the irony of this issue is that many of these items are forgeries, and in many cases, the forgeries are better than the originals. What's your estimation of that, Bob?
Well, I agree with James that there are a lot of forgeries and fakes out there. That's the majority of crimes that occur in the art market are not thefts outright. The book, we cover theft mostly, and we do some frauds and forgeries in there, but mostly it's theft. But truthfully, James is right in that the majority of crimes are forgeries, are fakes. It's people who are duped into buying pieces that are not real. And it's a shame that that occurs. But again, that's a situation where those who are going to buy need to know where they're buying from. They need to know that they have an authenticity guarantee, and also a guarantee that whoever they're buying it from will guarantee it for life, as long as they have it. So those are the things that you have to look out for. Over the course of the years, the pieces I recovered, we talk about in the book, they weren't fakes. I mean, these were the real McCoys, and of course, because they were the ones that were stolen off of the walls from the museums themselves. It was pretty easy to figure that out. But there are a number of outfits out there that have gone to jail and gotten in trouble for putting out fakes, and that's something that we're constantly fighting. It's not a cultural property crime. It's a straight-up fraud.
Robert in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you. I wish he could discuss a bit about the Barnes collection moving from the suburban museum designed by Dr. Barnes to downtown Philadelphia. I first learned about that by seeing the documentary film, The Art of the Steal, and there were a lot of proceedings and legal maneuverings before that occurred. It was the downtown Philadelphia interest against those that were supporting the keeping of the collection in the museum. Mm-hmm. I visited it after I saw that movie to see it in its original location, and you can buy a DVD and have some of the experience at your leisure without having to go there. But do you know when the move is going to be completed, and do you want to say anything about the conflict
that was involved in
the acquisition by the Philadelphia interests?
Sure. Thanks, Robert, for the question. I appreciate you calling in. And did you enjoy the museum, though?
I got there in time, and I'm also glad I got the DVD. I'd highly recommend it.
Hey, did you like the museum? It's a great collection, isn't it?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
As you described it, for learning and for the uniqueness of what he acquired, how he presented it, the whole history of it.
Right. Well, there's a couple of things, as far as the museum's concerned, it's a fantastic spot. Anyone who hasn't seen it or hasn't gotten a chance to go visit it, they really should. The second thing is it's going to be moving next year. Just to let you know, they're working on they actually closed the collection at this point. It's not open up in Lower Merion anymore. They're conserving all the paintings at this point. They're planning the move. It's going to be going down there probably next October or so. It'll be opening up at the new digs in Center City, Philadelphia. As for the movie, I thought the movie was it's an interesting documentary. It was made to create a feeling of this heist type of thing. It's actually very one-sided, and that's not a bad thing. It's just what they wanted to do. They wanted people to watch the movie and talk about it, and they wanted to sell DVDs. So that makes it interesting. And as for the move is concerned, I've been very closely associated with the museum for 20 years, and in some respects, I'm sorry to see it go, but in other respects, from the standpoint of conservation, security, the HVAC systems being upgraded, all of that, I think it's good for the collection. And secondly, what people don't realize is that the collection is going to be exhibited exactly as it is today in the old museum. In other words, the old museum is actually being rebuilt within an outer shell. And the outer shell will have better administrative areas, better conservation areas, better security. But the old walls, the wall ensembles, are going to be exactly as they are today. They're not being touched. So when you walk into the new museum, you're going to see exactly what you would see in the old one. So the experience of the visitor will not be changed. It's just going to be in a different area with better parking, better lighting, and better security.
Thanks, Robert, for that call. Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Yes. Several years ago, there was a series of thefts from, I believe it was the Ohio State Museum in the closed stacks, where a gentleman was going in and taking an X-Acto knife or a razor blade and cutting illustrated or specific pages out of books. I don't know if he was reselling them or how, but I wondered if your guest had any information on that kind of theft or if he's ever been involved in that kind, and I'll listen on the air.
Okay, thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Ed, and I'm glad to hear you from Baltimore. That's where I came from, so you're a hometown guy. Just to give you an idea, yeah, that's a very common situation. About every year, every 2 years or so, that happens. we get calls about that. The FBI was getting calls about that probably every 2 years. The largest one just occurred. It was just this year. There was an individual actually in Baltimore who was caught stealing presidential papers and documents out of the Maryland Historical Society. And I guess it's looking like he's been into a lot of different places since then or before that, and he's being looked at for a lot of material. It happened about 5 years ago up in Yale at the Beinecke Library, at the Rare Book Library there at Yale, where an individual was caught basically stealing maps out of books as well. And throughout my career, like I told you, probably every 2 to 3 years, we had another group doing that, another individual doing that. And that's what we're talking about when we say these people who have access to the collections, these experts, they're the ones that are actually we're looking at as being part of the group who do these thefts. And it's not unusual. You know, in Ohio State, I'm sure, you know, hopefully they have better security now and better collections management, that they won't have to worry about that again.
614-292-8513 if you want to get your calls in. We're running out of time. Bob Whitman, how do you teach other law enforcement officers how to do what you do?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, what you got to do is you have to explain how to work the cases. In other words, you don't look at a theft of a Renoir the same way you would, like I said, a Chevrolet. It's a whole different type of crime. Who are the people who would be interested in buying such an item? Who are the people who would be interested in stealing such an item? You don't dust a museum with fingerprint dust like you would a bank. Yeah, you know, those things have to be done very delicately because you don't want to damage other items. All those types of those types of investigative tools have to be looked at, and it's a little bit different from, like I say, a regular a crime that happens on the street. So, and there's other aspects as well. You know, to be able to recognize what a painting is supposed to look like. You know, if you have no idea what a Renoir looks like, it's tough to be able to identify it if you're an undercover situation where you're trying to buy one back, you know, for the police, as a buyer or dealer. So all those things are, part of the learning process for law enforcement.
There's in the Thomas Crown Affair, that movie, the insurance investigator plays a prominent role. How often do you interact with insurance investigators?
Well, Renee Russo, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
She looked great in a dress. Huh?
She's gorgeous. Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't wear a dress. So.
Okay.
It wasn't the same kind of situation. Since I retired in 2008, I've worked for a number of insurance companies. It's what we do now. Robert Whitman, okay. Incorporated, we're in the recovery protection business. And we actually go out and do investigations when there's an art heist, whether it's from an institution or gallery or private collector. So we do work with them quite a bit. A lot of that was Hollywood, but mm-hmm. It does happen. And we do. It's not an uncommon thing for an insurance company to try to make a recovery of a very valuable piece of art. And sometimes when the police give up, we start. That's how we look at it. Because, the law enforcement is going to go in, they're going to do an initial investigation, and then they're going to move on. And at that point is when we start to look at the situation and see what the new leads are from the standpoint of from the art business.
Robert Whitman, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, it was a great time, man. I appreciate you, having me on and speaking to the people of Columbus. It's a great group.
Robert Whitman's former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He's also co-author of the book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. He'll be speaking and signing that book on Saturday at the Columbus Art Design and Antique Market at the Columbus Museum of Art, sponsored by Garth's Auctions. And you can learn more about that if you go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. And thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7. WOSU HD1 and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.